And welcome back once again. We are joined on the Roscoe Morton Broadcast Tower, Huggy Huggins, who is a U-2 pilot, 25 years in the cockpit with the U-2. That's some high-flying adventures, I'll bet.
It is, but it wasn't 25 years all at one time. We don't have that much fuel, Steve.
So welcome to Oshkosh. You've been here before?
This is my 13th visit to Oshkosh. And if you remember back in 97, 07, and 08, we brought the U-2 in those 3 years. I was involved with that. Flew it in 07, flew it out in 08, and what just a great adventure here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you went from being civilian to flying the U-2.
Yeah, sure. I grew up in the space program. My dad was an engineer at NASA, and all the kids I went to school with were the kids of the astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Stu Russo, all their kids.
And oh, cool.
So kind of grew up around a lot of aviators. And went to the University of Texas, ROTC scholarship in the Air Force. Was trying to go Air Force or Navy, and the Air Force picked me up for a pilot slot. And 2 weeks after graduation, I'm in Del Rio, Texas, with pilot training going on for 52 weeks. My first assignment out of pilot training was as a T-38 instructor. So here I am 23 years old with the wings on and flying with 22-year-olds in a supersonic jet. And it was definitely a trial by fire. And a friend of mine had gone and done this thing called the U-2. I said the same thing back 25 years ago that people do now. Oh, they still fly those? And he told me all about it. I got very excited. It's an all volunteer program. You have to interview for it. They don't choose everybody. I went to the interview. Lo and behold, I got picked up, and it's been a great quarter of a century ride.
Excellent. The U-2, as you say, has been around for a long, long time. When the operational history started, when?
Well, today is August 1st. Today is the birthday of the first flight of the U-2. 59 years ago today.
Wow.
When the great Tony LeVere was doing a taxi test in what's called Area 51 now.
Right.
That was where it got its start. And he got airborne. He wasn't supposed to, because the official flight wasn't supposed to be until August 4th. So they kind of hushed it up. 3 days later, they brought the people out and did the first official flight. But today's actually our 59th birthday.
Excellent. Describe for folks who may not have seen the U-2 recently what exactly it looks like. I mean, I can try, but...
It looks a lot like the older version, the ones that were flying back in the 50s, or Gary Powers when he was shot down over Russia. Everybody remembers that from school. The plane looks the same, but it's about 30% larger. Went from an 80-foot wingspan to 104-foot wingspan. So side by side, it's definitely bigger. But if you just looked at the U-2, a very, very long wing. People call it a glider wing. Very, very long, skinny wing. And only 65 feet long, but 104 feet wide. But so it's designed to have that very, very high lift wing to get us to the upper parts of the stratosphere.
Right. And how high can it fly?
Officially,
not...
I can tell you, but then I'm going to have to kill you,
yeah,
Steve.
Yeah, that's right.
we can go above 70,000 feet.
Right. And at that point, you're really looking... You're looking into space at that point.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a bright day like you would have out here, but as you look at the sky, and you start the blues, and they get darker and darker, and it just goes to black, but it's a stunning view out there.
All right. Describe for us a typical mission for the U-2. I mean, your takeoff and landing are... unconventional, shall we say?
Well, they are. When they were designing the aircraft to save weight, they wanted the outrigger wheels. The main gear, our bicycle landing gear.
Right.
But you've got the outrigger wheels to give it a stable purpose. But to have those retract like you would on a Harrier or a B-52, you have to have plumbing and all the gearing. And Kelly Johnson, the designer, came up with this idea: let's just have them fall off. So as we roll down the runway and the wing gets lift, starts to flex up, those wheels tumble off and down the runway. And you go fly your mission, and when you come back, you're landing, in essence, a motorcycle with a 104-foot wingspan.
Right.
So it's very unconventional. It's a tail dragger, but a very unstable tail dragger. Like any tail dragger. If you push a golf cart backwards and let go of it, it wants to spin around. But for the 9-10 hours of flight in between, we're generally on the autopilot because the aircraft is a handful to fly, and we're doing a lot of other things in the course of the mission. And we need to have that. We need to have the autopilot flight so I can actually do the mission things I need to do with the aircraft.
So that's one of the big differences between the U-2 and the SR-71s, where the SR-71, you've got a pilot up front and your systems officer in the back taking care of all those things. With the U-2, single person, you're taking care of the whole thing.
Quite a bit, but one of the advantages we have now, we have data links. So even though let's say I'm over Afghanistan, I have a data link that takes all my information digitally back to Beale Air Force Base in California or one of another few ground sites. And they're seeing it real time. So I, in essence, have 40 people in the back of my aircraft. We're connected by data link. So I am by myself in the aircraft, but there are a team of intel experts that are looking at everything and talking to me. And it really is the team effort.
Where are some of the, if you can tell me, some of the interesting places that you've had overflights?
I was Well, Afghanistan.
Right.
Not a big threat out there, but the country is just so stunning from the air. 25,000-foot peaks in the north. It's a geologist's dream out there. I was the first person to overfly Bosnia-Herzegovina back in the 90s when they had the conflict brewing up over there. Flew Desert Storm, Desert Shield opening day, Kosovo. I was stationed in England for 3 years, and just a beautiful place to fly out of. So, in fact, just last month I ferried a jet back from England and back to the U.S. Flew over Greenland in June. Over Greenland, it was clear and it was absolutely stunning, just beautiful.
Great. When you brought the airplane here for Oshkosh, 2008, you mentioned.
Brought it in 07. Well, I flew it in 07. Flew it out in 08.
Okay. What kind of preparations do you need? Obviously, when you're at your home base, you've got everything you need. But how did you transfer all of that knowledge and personnel here to actually land at Whitman Region?
It's a lot of logistical work and a lot of planning. We have a very unique fuel we use. It's similar to normal jet fuel, but it's similar but different. We have to get that sent out here, so we have to plan that out. We sent out a team of about 15 people, maintenance people to take care of the spacesuit, and we usually bring out one of the black T-38s that you usually see on the West Ramp. So a big team of people to kind of get here, get set up before I actually fly in or get the aircrafts here. So it just looks like I show up and everything's good, but there's a lot of plan. We have to get all that information trucked out. There's a lot of specialized tow bar. So getting the airlift, we'll try to work with a C-130 unit that may be coming to the show, get them to pop through and get everything and pull it out here. So it takes months of planning to make everything fall together, as right. You well know.
So the real question with that arrival was, did you have to fly to Fisk and then in, or did they just clear you direct?
I wanted to so bad. Black U-2, rock your wings.
That would have been good. Or Piper Cub, follow the U-2 in front of you.
Well, the beauty of it is I can fly the airspeeds. I can fly 90 knots in the U-2 down there.
Really?
No problem. I could get in with the traffic just fine.
Oh, my goodness. What you mentioned the slow end, but as you go up higher, what's the top end or regular cruise speed that you would be flying?
We regularly, we take off and we pitch up and climb out at 160 knots indicated. And we stay at 160 until 52,000 feet. And at 52,000 feet, that's where 160 knots intersects about 0.7, 0.71 Mach. And then we continue to climb at 0.7, 0.71, somewhere in there. Almost all the time we're full power, the entire flight, so 10, 11, 12 hours, whatever it is, full power, and we just continue to cruise climb. As the plane gets lighter, we'll go higher and higher and higher. And literally the highest altitude we have is before we start the descent,
wow.
Which the first step of the descent checklist, surprisingly, is gear down. Got to put some drag on that airplane to get it to come down.
What about heat at those kinds of altitudes?
Heat?
Yeah, how is that building up on the airframe?
We're slow enough speeds. It's not a factor. The heat issue we have is with the pressure suit. So we're wearing the full pressure suit out there, and we have a cooling system that comes in off the aircraft that blows cooling air into the pressure suit. If you lost that cooling air, it's going to be an immediate abort. Imagine sitting out here at Oshkosh wearing a dry suit or a wetsuit. Your body's core temperature is going to heat up dramatically, very very quickly. And it would be dangerous for your health. So if we were to lose air conditioning, we're an immediate abort. Fortunately, that's a very, very rare occurrence. But that's the only heat problem that we have in the U-2.
Okay. So it's the worrying about the pilot more than
exactly.
The systems. Good. And you're here at Oshkosh. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, I'm just having a good time.
Okay.
You know, in years past, I've come out here with the Air Force, but this time I took leave and came out, and I'm just moving into just picked up a new job. I'm retiring here in the coming days, and I'm now I'll be the executive director of Citation Jet Pilots, CJP, the owner pilot organization for
okay.
CJP.
Excellent. And if you're taking that job, obviously you have civilian experience as well.
I do. I've actually flown about 95 different types of aircraft in my life.
Oh,
I like to get into anything and everything I can. I just love flying.
Great. Any favorites? In your logbook?
You know, my favorite one is the one I'm going to get to fly tomorrow.
It's a standard pilot answer. That's a good one. So if folks are interested in talking more with you, you're in Kristen Hill's booth, correct?
I will be over at Kristen Hill. And Kristen, aviation artist, she's over in Hangar A, 1158, right on the east side of the hangar.
Right.
And I'll be over there from 12:30 to 1:30. She has a cast of various interesting pilots that come roll through there, and she's been gracious enough to let me come through. She's done a lot of artwork with the U-2 that she's donated to the Air Force, And she has some of that on display out there. So I would really encourage people to come by. She's a fantastic artist.
Great. And that is Hangar A, booth 1158. So stop in. We appreciate you taking some time out of your day today. And hopefully you will have some time to go look around at airplanes here at Oshkosh before you have to go home.
Steve, I'm honored. Thank you so much for having me out here.
Thank you. Huggy Huggins joining us here. And we will be back in just a little bit to talk with Amelia Rose Earhart about flying around the world. And we'll do that in just a moment live on EIA Radio.